It's my pleasure, as it is every quarter, to welcome Al Friedberg, the Chief Investment Officer, Portfolio Manager of the Friedberg Global Macro Hedge Fund and the Friedberg Asset Allocation Fund. Hi, Al. How you doing?
Good morning, David.
Good. Just before we start, a little bit of housekeeping. As we try to do every quarter, we're going to speak for about 40 minutes. I'm going to act as an interlocutor, and I welcome questions. Some people have sent me questions already by email. If you have questions, please send them to our colleague, erot@niagaracapital.ca, erot@niagaracapital.ca. And if you're unable to stay with us through the whole 40 minutes, we'll be posting this interview on the Friedberg website, and we'll be sending a link to it from Niagara Capital. I'm going to start off this morning a little bit differently than we have in previous conversations. I'm going to ask you the last question that I'm going to put to you, or I'm going to put to you now the last question that I'm going to ask you to respond to at the end of our interview, and that is this: in your quarterly report, you speak with a moral tone and end by explaining that some of the reasons for your moral umbrage that you take with government actions explains the difficulties of making directional bets in the Global Macro Fund in particular. At the same time, you very often railed against hedge funds not being able to deliver what they promised to deliver and charging exorbitant fees. Do the two things match? That's going to be the last question that I'm going to put to you, and I'm going to save 5 minutes at the end for it. Now, to come back to the first, let's start with your view of the Fed. We have a very highly expansionary Fed, and yet, whereas in the past you've been very quick to act in response to monetary measures like the ones that the Fed has undertaken now, you've not become an outright bull on risk assets. And I think what surprised a lot of investors and a lot of readers is your reluctance to take a step into the gold market. In fact, you've retreated, if anything, from gold. Can you talk about that a bit, please?
Yeah, right. Okay. That's a good question. And the point is this: the Fed has been engaged in on a very expansionary course. But of course, money creation is not just up to the Fed; it's also up to it, to the banking system, the commercial banks, and they have to put to work the excess reserves that they have been given, So whereas the Fed is buying securities and creating money, let's say, out of thin air, anywhere between 45 and 85 billion, I think in another month it will become something like $85 billion a month, which is a tremendous amount of money. The banking system has as yet not been able to mobilize this excess reserves on a proportional basis. I'm not saying that they are not expanding credit, and credit is expanding, and they're expanding loans and expanding assets by purchasing treasuries, but not in the same proportion as the Fed would want them to do. We did note in the last few months a slight acceleration in the expansion of the balance sheets of the banks, but not sufficient to really tell us that we are now on course for a very substantial increase in nominal GDP. So we're still waiting for an acceleration in money. And if and when it does come, of course, we will become a little bit more aggressive in positioning ourselves.
Do you think that is it possible that we could have an expansion in money without a commensurate expansion in GDP?
Yes, we can have a very large expansion in nominal GDP, which is you can have a real GDP falling and a nominal GDP rising. So you could have theoretically a situation where the economy is shrinking, you're in a recession, you're in a deep recession, minus 2%, minus 3%, minus 4%. And yet, at the same time, inflation is high enough that keeps nominal GDP rising. That has happened often in an example, Latin American countries. They've had recessions accompanied with high rates of inflation, and therefore nominal GDP has risen.
Does the so far restrained growth of money is that what explains your reluctance to step into gold or your retreat from gold?
Well, it's not exactly. It's really more like a reluctance to engage fully in risk assets. It's not just gold. I think it's in anything. We happen to have a fairly neutral, maybe slightly negative position in assets, in risk assets. We are probably slightly, but very very slightly, risk off. And gold is one of the risk assets, so it's part of that. Now, it's a separate story as to which assets you want to be long and which assets you want to be short. And the assets that we want to be long, we found that still today, until today, basically, equities, at least U.S. equities, have performed better than gold. Don't know exactly why. I can only speculate that the large gains that we have in gold have to be consolidated, that probably there's a huge amount of physical gold coming into the market. You can probably see everywhere little stores cash for gold, almost in every city in the world. So I imagine that a very large amount of gold is coming into the market. Probably demand has fallen off in centers like India, which typically buy gold as gifts. So the market needs to consolidate, and maybe the consolidation period can last another few more months or maybe another few more years. We don't know. All we know is that for now, the market is acting more or less as being in balance, supply and demand in balance, and therefore not performing better than other risk assets.
Is it perhaps the carrying charge, even though it's very slight, is competing with the dividend yield of stock?
It could be. That's part of it. Could be. It's still negative to carry gold. Maybe it's 1% a year, 1.5% a year, whereas dividends, where equities have a 2% return, could be. That may be a good simple explanation, but generally speaking, those differences that doesn't make a big difference once the market is in better shape technically. And as I say, I think that probably the market is digesting a very large amount of supply coming in.
You've talked in recent weeks in conversations internally about, in very dramatic terms, about recession and even depression, global depression. Is your view regarding commodities a kind of competition between that view of a world in which growth seems to be virtually impossible and this money supply growth? Is there a competition between the two forces now? Is that what's holding commodities in a relatively not so much narrow but not so much wide band, but a band nonetheless?
Yeah, I think that. Given economic conditions around the world, and we have very weak growth around the world, I think this is one of the weakest periods of economic growth that we've had in the last 60 or 70 years, especially because it's so generalized. You have weakness in Asia, you have weakness in Europe, you have weakness in the U.S. The U.S. maybe is not weak, but it's certainly not strong. So Given this scenario, commodity prices, of course, should be much lower. The problem is that the cost to carry commodities, the speculative cost to carry commodities, the fact that money is so cheap, has made holders reluctant to part with commodities, just like holders are reluctant, as an example, to part with real estate, bad real estate. There has not really been a cleansing of the market in real estate because the holders of real estate have had very low opportunity cost. So, and to the extent that money is cheap, this has allowed, to the extent the money is cheap, this has allowed holders to stay with assets longer than under normal conditions. I think that this has tended to hold commodity prices higher than they should, and in some sense, this has also slowed down, and this is something that maybe the Fed has not taken into account. It's happened before. It has slowed down the adjustment and therefore slowed down the recovery. Prices of many assets are too high, are still too high, and this does not allow for better equilibrium in the markets, and therefore there's less growth. So I think that the answer then is yes, cheap money has this negative effect in that it holds prices up, keeps commodity prices higher than they should, keeps many real estate prices higher than they should.
Doesn't, on the commodity front, doesn't this encourage suppliers to increase supply in excess of what's actually required from an economic point of view?
Yes, they
putting
do.
Pressure on storage
yes, they
costs.
They do.
And ultimately, doesn't that predict a bear market of really some violent proportions?
They do, correct. The supply, to the extent that commodity prices are higher than they should, supplies are increasing, and we do see in commodities a buildup in inventories. I think I was pointing out the other day in aluminum, inventories are extremely high. So, yes, we probably are getting a much higher supply response than we should. And when and if interest rates ever go up and makes it more difficult to hold on to this inventories, you're going to see a large decline in commodity prices.
But at the same time, you at present don't have a directional bet on commodities.
We are probably net short commodities because we have a very large short position in oil, and we have light long positions in a number of other commodities. I'd say that net-net, we are probably long maybe an equivalent to 7 or 8% of the assets of the fund. We're probably short. I'm sorry. We're probably short.
Short.
7 or 8% of the assets.
And that short bet is localized particularly in industrial
oil.
Commodities and oil in particular.
And crude oil, correct.
Right. Speaking about interest rates, I have a question from an investor who about interest rates, and I'll read it to you. What do you think of a play on short interest rates in the U.S., specifically that they might rise given that the market's fully discounting no increase at all until 2015? Seems to me this is a low-risk, high-potential reward type of trade.
Yeah, I agree. I think that we did that also for a little while. You can bet on rising short-term rates with little cost, not a lot of cost. You know, it's a little bit of cost, and if you want to take those small costs and do trades of that kind, you can. Problem is that short-term rates are really manipulated by the Fed. It's not as if it's a market-driven result here. You're in the hands of the Fed. The Fed may decide to keep rates down for longer than we think. They may decide to go to zero, and right now they're still about 25 basis points or so positive. So it is a low cost bet, but at the same time it's a bet that is that maybe may not pay off big. I can't tell. And this is one of the problems that we have today and that most hedge funds have today is that markets are not, you can't understand markets today the way we used to before because of so much government interference. and it just blurs the picture, and so you can't really make the same type of calculations you used to make before.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the bets that you're really committed to. One of those is in housing. You've held housing stocks for about the past year. They represent the lion's share of your long position in equities, a big part of the long side of your to the extent that you're long risk assets. That's where you've placed a big part of your bet. Housing market prices are rising, sales are not increasing. Where do you stand with that now? Can you elaborate a bit? What's the play?
Yeah, when we went long the housing sector, there was a lot of skepticism about it, and there was a lot of talk of overhanging supplies, overhanging inventories. They still are today from the crisis, but. And I think that skepticism has now turned. I think that most people are relatively optimistic about the housing sector and about this housing sector becoming a positive contributor to the economy. The question is how much of an improvement. And our bet is that the inflation being created, that monetary inflation being created by the Fed, and which actually expresses itself well today in very low, very, very low mortgage rates, making housing accessible to many, many people, will have a more profound effect on housing than it's generally understood. I think that the market, for instance, is saying housing stocks, as an example, have raced ahead of their prospects. They are trading as if starts would be in the area of 2.6 million houses, when in fact they're trading under 1 million. In fact, we have starts at under 1 million starts. I don't think that the market is yet internalized the idea that if you want a house, and if you want the a particular house, and not those that were built and became vacated and they're no longer sort of desirable homes. So if you want a home, you're going to have to pay a premium. The margins, the prices are rising, and the margins for developers and for house builders is much larger than it used to be. Other than the fact, of course, that many of them don't even have land holdings anymore. Many of the real estate companies, they lost their land holdings, so they are quickly trying to get back into the land business and acquire land inventory. But we believe that the margins are going to be spectacular, and so even with sales not moving as fast, and that's because of shortages. In supply, even with sales not moving as fast as we all expect, but the profit margins are very large, and therefore we think that housing is still a good place to be.
You've got a
and it's one of the excellent beneficiaries, one of the primary beneficiaries of this Federal Reserve policy. Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to speak about housing in Canada. You have a view of it as well, not nearly as intense a view, but it's expressed itself in a modest short position in Canadian banks. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, it's no more. It really is based on the fact that we have had a phenomenal increase in condominium building in the two major cities of Vancouver and Toronto. This has been financed to a large extent by the banks and maybe also intermediaries. And there probably will be some very substantial losses in that area. I'm not really sure. I can't really tell you much about whether the overall housing market in Canada is at risk. I think that it's mostly localized in the condominium area. But what it does is it calls attention, and we've recently had one of the rating agencies downgrade Canadian banks' credit. It calls attention to their vulnerability to this market. And it calls attention to vulnerability in this market in the context of them trading, Canadian banks trading, at multiples of book that are much higher than anywhere else in the world. You're talking about multiples that are maybe 3 or 4 times, or maybe 5 times sometimes higher than any other of the major banks around the world. So it's really a relative valuation play. I think Canadian banks are well managed for the most part, but they are becoming more and more integrated in the world market, so they will probably suffer to the extent that other ones do. They will probably also suffer somewhat, and they may get hurt in their condo exposure. And I think the market will say finally that, you know, 2.5 times book is a bit excessive, and maybe they should be trading at 1 or 1.5 times book.
Al, if there's been a single trade that I think has captured your loyalty over the past decade, at least, it's been TIPS. There's been a lot of guys in the fixed income space and the credit space looking at higher yielding corporates. You've stayed loyal to TIPS, and you've stayed loyal to TIPS as really the environment has changed and the wind blows yet for another changing environment. What is the play going forward now with TIPS?
Well, TIPS have been an extraordinarily good performer. They've done better than the run of the mill nominal treasuries, and of course the reason is because they give you that inflation protection, which regardless of government protestations that inflation is not a problem, we have seen inflation higher than expected for the past 10, 15 years. And it's always been, or it's been mostly accumulated in food and in fuel. But from time to time, there is other factors that come into this. So the CPI index that is used reflects broader forces than what you call the PCE deflator, as an example. So at any rate, the TIPS have been reflecting this, and as a result, when you look at TIPS, you got to look at real yields. So you can say, you know, what are the real yields? And we've been saying for the past many years that the real yields will be falling, and in a recessionary environment that we have today. And we'll get to zero, and actually we've gone to negative for the first 10 or 15 years. We've gone to negative. We have negative real yields. There is still some positive yield to be had at the very long end of the curve. I think the maturities in 40s and forward show something like 35 to 40 basis points yield. We think that will also go to a negative rate eventually. So there is good upside in this market still. The market is worrying about monetary expansion, about what it will do to inflation, as we spoke earlier, what it will do to nominal GDP. It's an uncertainty that nobody can determine in advance. Therefore, you have to have a premium for that uncertainty, and the market does not reflect the premium for uncertainty yet. All in all, we think that that's been the best playing credit, because at least it's the only AAA that we have, so we don't have to worry about the soundness of the credit, and at the same time we have this this option on the CPI. First of all, we have the CPI itself, and then we have the option on the movement of the CPI that's practically free.
When you speak in a cautionary tone about the world environment, surely the two soggiest places in it are Japan and in Europe. You haven't been playing Japan. I'm going to ask you about that in a minute, but you have been trading the Eurozone in a number of different ways. What are you expecting there, and what's your current view, and how do you think it's going to play out?
Well, the Eurozone is adjusting in economic terms. The adjustment is very, very slow. The reason it's very slow is because the northern countries, Germany and Holland and so on, have been financing a lot of their needs, so that the counterpart is that the debt in the countries that have problems has increased a great deal. But because of that, because they've been able to use a credit card, they have not had to adjust as much as they should have adjusted if they couldn't get the credit card, if they couldn't use the credit card. So in the first place, then, adjustment is proceeding, but proceeding at a much too slow a pace that probably democratic countries can't sustain for much longer. And it's my strong belief is that at some point these countries will default on the official debt. Now, that does not necessarily mean that they will be out of the euro, or that it will affect the euro dollar, or that they will be out of the eurozone. But it does mean that they cannot continue to service mounting debt. Like Greek debt today, as an example, is 185% of GDP. This is after they have punished the private holders. They have taken away 75% of the value of the private debt, and this is starting from less than 100% 4 years ago. So they are not making any headway. Now, there is one headway that most of them are making, and that is the very severe contraction in, or the rise in tax rates and the cutbacks in spending have now made some of these countries achieve a primary surplus. So as an example,
by primary you mean a surplus,
a primary,
net
of
interest payments.
Yeah, a primary budget surplus, which is, that's right, excess out interest payments. So their taxes, their spending minus taxes, for Portugal as an example, is already is positive. And for Greece and let's say Ireland, the numbers are small, the deficit is small. Cyprus, which has got a terrible banking problem, has gone into surplus. Now, what does that mean? Well, that means that they are now getting closer and closer to a situation where they can say, we can default on the debt and still have enough money to pay our bills. They couldn't do that 2 years ago. 2 years ago, Greece, the deficit was huge, even without interest payments, even without having to service the debt. So Greece couldn't actually say, we're defaulting on the debt, because they had nothing to gain. Now they have something to gain, some of these countries. They're getting closer to the point where they can say, well, if we don't pay interest on the debt, if we don't service any of the debt, we now can pay our bills. And so it's getting more dangerous for the creditors. As we keep going, it's getting more and more dangerous for the creditors. And eventually it will result in Cyprus and Greece and Spain and Portugal and some of these countries say, we are not going to pay. Let's sit down at the table and let's either cut the debt that we have, or restructure in such a way that we have to pay no interest for the next 50 years. So something drastic enough that will make it as if they are almost not paying any interest.
Well, it's certainly a much more politically palatable posture to take.
Right, right. And I think that a government that does that will probably be very popular at this point.
Go ahead.
No, so I think that this is going to be happening. I think that to think otherwise is to dream. Democratic governments cannot go through 5 years of depression and then find that their debt is still higher than it was when they started, and that they're going to have to actually work for the next 50 years under these conditions. So it's clear to me that some type of a default is in the making, or will be coming, and I think it's just a function of how close they get to achieving primary surpluses. Now, that's Europe. There's been also some progress. Again, this is because of the adjustment. There's been some progress in the external sector of some of these countries. Their current account is swinging from very deep deficits to much more moderate deficits, in some cases surpluses. So that means that there is an external adjustment that's taken place, and that resulted not because of a devaluation, because you can't devalue the euro, but because of an internal devaluation, which has to do with wages. Their wages are coming down. Again, they didn't come down fast enough because they were able to use the credit card, but it's still coming down, and in many cases now these countries have adjusted better to world economic conditions, and they're more competitive. So whether they will actually leave the euro and try to achieve another 15 or 20% devaluation, I don't know. That's difficult to know, and it's difficult also to foresee the type of mechanism that will be used. But certainly the first part, the default, is inevitable.
Now, I think that if you can read the tone of the mood of investors today, I think that there's two types of worry, and I don't think there's much more than worry. One is very soggy markets in response to very soggy economic conditions, but the other is, I think, a fear of an accident occurring in the banking sector because of opacity. There's something that we don't know about. Something terrible could happen, something that's akin to 2008, a Hurricane Sandy type event somewhere, probably emanating from Europe. And I think that in this labyrinth of news, most people, when they hear the word default, think that that would be the trigger for it. Do you think that there is a potential accident at play? Do you think that it would originate in the default? You haven't spoken about this for the past while.
I think that the event of default could be the accident that the market can shock the market. I think that waking up one morning and opening up the newspaper and finding out that Greece decided to default on its public debt, or Spain decided to default on its public debt, could be pretty shocking to the system. And no doubt in my mind that if one of them does it, the other ones will probably join fairly quickly after that. So the market will be in a crisis mode. So that possibility is ever existing, and we're living at the edge of we're living at the edge. I mean, we can't even say that this is something that's unknown. This is something that's known. It's a known uncertainty in the sense that it's a known unknown, I think they used to call it, in the sense that we know that that will happen. We just don't know exactly under what conditions or when. But there are other possibilities that can make a difference. I mean, we could have some Middle East conflict where Iran is attacked and it's last longer than we think it would last, and there is some severe impact in the oil market. That can accelerate the downturn in the world economy. There could be, everybody's expecting the fiscal cliff in the United States to be resolved, because it should be resolved, because it makes sense to be resolved. But what if it's not resolved? You know, so that's something. That's another possibility. There are too many. The fragility is evident. You know, there's a lot of things that right now that are not working the way they should. The world economy is not well grounded, and you have so many. And this is maybe the source. This uncertainty is the source of the reluctance of banks to extend credit, of the reluctance of corporations to spend money, capital spending. We need to resolve these things, these issues, and I think the primary issue is Europe. The next issue is probably the U.S. fiscal cliff and U.S. and debt policy in general for the U.S. I think if we can resolve it, and I wrote that, and I still think so, that no matter how we resolve it, but once we resolve it, the markets will do better. So there may be a disaster, and maybe it may involve a default, and maybe huge losses, and there may be banks that fall and fail. But that's a resolution. Once we go through that, I think the markets will do better.
Let's turn just briefly, and I say briefly because I know you don't have a position in it, to Japan, where potentially the greatest disaster looms. And then, if we could, I'm going to circle back to the very first question, which, as I said, will be our last. Japan has is the most heavily indebted country. The yen has started to break down. The view is that the market may do what the central bank has been unable to do. Do you have a take on Japan?
We have lost interest in Japan for years now. It's difficult to read it properly. The country has been in a moderate deflation for the last 10-15 years. It's light because it's no more than about 1% a year decline in prices. We've had a very, very long deflation in assets. I mean, land prices today are back to what they were in 1975. You know, if we think about it, I mean, anybody who's listening, who lives in the United States or Europe or where have you, if you think back, where can you find a place that land prices are today below where they were in 1975? That's pretty remarkable. So, and at the same time, the government's debt continues to increase. It's come to the point that it is unsustainable, and yet it is sustained. Yet JGBs are still trading at a remarkable 1% or less than 1% a year interest. So the market, the local market is still very loyal to the government market. They're still buying those bonds. The banks are buying those bonds. I think everybody's burying their head in the sand, and they're buying them. So I'm not really sure how long this can continue. I also think that the Japanese population generally is fairly docile and is fairly obedient, and so it may not be possible for the government at some point to say, gentlemen and ladies and gentlemen, I think that we the debt that we have cannot be repaid, so here's what we're going to do. We're going to give you, for every dollar bond that you have, for every $100, we're going to give you a new bond that is 25 cents or 50 cents, and we'll give you also a nice mansion or a nice house somewhere, one of the assets that we have. In other words, the government can do certain things that the population will accept, it's impossible for us to try to figure out what will happen with that. But what's interesting is that Japan is now, from running a very large current account surplus, has now gone into a...
Right, running a deficit.
A current account deficit.
Yeah.
And, you know, that means that in some way, it means that their yen is probably too expensive. It may mean that. It may also mean that that the country is spending more than it is saving. It's not so clear. We do know that a lot of the international companies, the international multinationals, have moved their operations away from Japan, and they have gone to Southeast Asia, they've gone to the United States, and they are profitable, and they remit money home, and so from a trade deficit, in other words, the other side of it is, instead of having a trade surplus, they have a trade deficit, but at the same time, they have investment flows going back home. So it's not, in our view, it's not a picture that we can take advantage of. There's no clarity here. By the way, Japanese equities today are very cheap. They're cheaper than they've been in 20 years. But there's not an important catalyst to make them move, and there's no important catalyst to make the yen go down, and there's no catalyst to see the JGB market breaking, and this can last again another 3 months or another 5 years. So because we don't have a clear catalyst, I think we're staying out of it.
Okay, let's come back to the beginning if we could. In your quarterly report, which incidentally I thought was one of the best ones that you've written in years, you take umbrage at three government actions, and you conclude that not in a self-serving way, that the results of these actions is one of the reasons that you've positioned the portfolio as you have in a non-directional, safe way. At the same time, and completely separately, you've spoken about hedge funds having underperforming and having difficulties, and yet this year, unlike past years, we are just one of the pack. How can an investor expect better in an environment where the government and normal economic forces are operating in an experimental way, so opposed to one another? How should an investor position oneself?
I think that if hedge funds have problems, professionals like hedge fund managers have problems positioning themselves, it's a lot to ask of lay people who make a living doing other things and who hope to profit from the market. I think that the problems that we have, everybody has, and it's probably, in my view, it's probably true that in normal conditions, if you had a quote unquote normal market like you had in the 90s, run of the mill funds, regular long only funds will probably do better. And then the hedge funds. I think that they will do better because they don't take into account risk. I mean, this is their mandate. The mandate is to go long. Risk is not something that they really consider. They don't manage risk. And so...
You mean their beta plays.
Yeah, so I that's right. And I think that they'll do better. Where the advantages in owning hedge funds, if they're well managed, is that they are more capable of taking on markets that are more complicated. And this year is one of the market, one of the times that the markets are more complicated. Actually, they're underperforming is because the long only funds have not really cared so much about risk, and they're still doing well. But it's likely, I would say, that in the next 1 or 2 years, hedge funds will outperform long-only funds, as an example. And that's what I think. At the same time, it's also likely that we will have major disasters in the hedge fund industry because some things will fail catastrophically, and that's where they're going to be. So I'm not really sure what to say, where investors should position. I think the investor should try to look for
Let me interrupt you if I could. What I mean by that is what kind of expectations, not so much position, but what type of expectations should an investor have in an environment like this? So as not to be either disappointed or, you know, you don't want to become a chaser of Apple computer.
David, you know, the answer is very simple and it's staring us in the face, which is treasuries, risk-free treasuries yield anywhere between 0.25, means 25 basis points, to 3%. So and that's risk-free. So anybody who thinks it can do better it may be dreaming. I think that that's what the expectation should be. Expectations should be bound by what risk-free rates are. And if risk-free rates persist in being 1% or 2% or 0.5%, that's what you're going to expect. If you want more, you're going to have to take some substantial risk. And I think anybody who doesn't think that he's taking risk buying a corporate that yields 6% or buying a stock that has a dividend yield of 3%, anybody who doesn't think he's taking more risk, I think he's wrong. I think he's deluding himself. having said that, the spread, the premium, the equity risk premium, the spread between stocks and fixed income has gotten fairly large now. Stocks trade with something of 7 or 8% earning yield, and that's getting more reasonable. But of course, there is the business cycle risk, and there, in today, superimposed on the that cycle risk, there is also a regulatory risk, and there is a compliance risk, and so those are heavy risks, very very heavy risks, and so I'm not sure that an investor should be looking then to earn much more than the risk-free rates that we have today.
Okay, Al, thank you. Thank you very much for sharing your views, your imaginative views as always. We've exceeded our limit by a few minutes, but I think they were minutes worthwhile spent. I thank you for them again. As I remind investors, the contents of the call will be posted on the Friedberg website, and a link will be sent to it from the Niagara people. Al, I thank you, and I wish all listeners a good investing going forward.
Okay, thank you, David.
Bye bye. Bye bye.